Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
This is the Hagman Report, where truth can't be silenced. I want to welcome everyone to today's edition of the Hagman Report, HagmanReport.com. We changed some things around a little bit. Disregard Hagman Report Live. Go to HagmanReport.com. Bookmark that website, HagmanReport.com. Bookmark HagmanReport.com. Remember, two N's on Hagman. And on the top part of the screen, you'll see a banner that says Hagman Report Live. And, of course, you click on that and it'll take you right to our page of all of our videos, all of the audio, everything you want right there. It's really simple. We really simplified it for everyone. All right, HagmanReport.com. Also, you'll find the print articles there, show prep, everything you need is at that location, that one location, HagmanReport.com. Also, HagmanStore.com for some of the greatest coffee you'll ever need, want, have. I've got to tell you, this is gourmet coffee. Proceeds of which go to two organizations to help fight against the scourge of child and human sex trafficking. Check out our coffee. Please do that. Three different kinds. Detective's Choice, my go-to. That's hyper-caffeinated. You have three types, whole bean, ground, and K-cups. And, of course, other blends include Revolution and Patriot blends, aptly named. They're on the dark side, all of them, of course. Detective's Choice being the darkest of the three. And, again, hyper-caffeinated. That's HagmanStore.com, HagmanStore.com. I have a very special guest with me right now, and I want to get right to it. His name is Sam Adams. I'm sorry, Andrews. I do that all the time. Pass me the Budweiser, Eric, the tech, for crying out loud. I mean, it's what's wrong with me, right?
Budweiser's nasty.
Or whatever. Coors, I'm sorry. Yes. or Sam Adams. No, Sam Andrews is with me. And I do that all the time. I don't know why. I apologize. He is truly a legend. A true legend. If you listen to the John Moore radio show, Liberty Man, okay, who was on yesterday, you know exactly who this gentleman is. He is a veteran. He's, let me tell you something. He's a high-end weapons manufacturer in addition to teaching people how to, teaching people about handling weapons. I don't want to misstate his qualifications. So rather than me do this, I'm going to bring him on and come kind of out of the gate, ask him two questions, tell us a little bit about himself. And then I want to kind of get into what we spoke about this past weekend a little bit. It was an impromptu conversation. It was me calling him up to introduce myself and to talk about or ask him to come on today. And then we had this just marvelous conversation about where we're at today and how things were. Things are going. I mean, here we are 21 days away from the general election. Look at it out there. Look out your windows, especially if you're in the Pacific Northwest. Look out your windows or in the Northeast or any urban areas. See what's going on. With that, Sam Andrews, welcome to the Hagman Report, sir.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Hagman. I really enjoyed our conversation this weekend, and I know my wife is going to be really excited about the coffee that you sell because she loves coffee.
I do, too. I mean, I'll tell you what, that's just about all I drink. My doctor's saying, yeah, your blood's going to be coarse, you know, pumping coffee all the time. Yeah, by the way, I just learned something great about your wife off air, and I don't know if you even want to mention that or not. But
Sure. Her name is Ruth Andrews, and she is an extraordinary therapist. She works with satanic ritual abuse clients and sex trafficked clients. That is her specialty. She is an amazing diagnostician, which, of course, is one of the first steps to helping someone. And she's probably helped more human beings in her life than any 10 people I've met added together. She's an amazing woman, and I'm very fortunate and blessed to have her for a wife.
Wow. No, great. Great to know that. How kind of you to say that. Yeah, that fascinates me. I mean, that's great. What a, wow, what a sacrifice she would make to be in that position, to do that job. That'd be a tough job. Tell the audience a little bit about yourself. Those who don't know you, and I can't believe no one knows you, but, go ahead and give yourself or introduce yourself, and then, let's get into the meat of the conversation.
Well, I'm an Italian American. There's a book written about my Italian ancestors, written by a Catholic priest. It talks about this Italian family, the Brunettis, that settled the western part of Mississippi and the eastern part of Arkansas. They were farmers. I think the book's called The Delta Italians. And I was adopted at the age of 3 by a command sergeant major whose father was an inventor. And my grandfather invented the flexographic printing process in 1946. And there's a book written about him and a good gentleman named John Avery. John Avery developed the pressure-sensitive label paper, and my father developed the machines and the process to print on it. And there's a book, very dry book. If you're not a printing insider, I wouldn't recommend it. But it's called They Began an Industry, is the title of that book. And so I grew up with entrepreneurs and engineers for fathers, grandfathers, and uncles. And they were stern men. They were serious men. And they were disciplined men. And they were very, very careful in how they raised their children. We were asked to, demanded to study Greek and Hebrew on Wednesday nights, Saturday nights, and Sunday mornings. We spent a good chunk of our youth in the scriptures. And these were logical men. These were men that demanded truth at every moment. And there was no wiggle room. Things were black and white with the men that raised me. And I benefited from this discipline enormously in my life. And I can't thank my grandfathers, my uncles, and my father enough. They raised us in a way, if you were a boy in my family, you were responsible to understand how everything worked. And so if you were in the garage with your uncle working on a project and he might look at you and say, son, do you know how a magnetic particle clutch works? And of course, as a young child, I would say, well, no, Uncle Dave, I have no idea how that works. And he would say, well, come here, boy, you need to know. Oh, and my. That was the environment that I grew up in. We actually built a printing press in my father's basement when I was 7 years old from scratch to run labels for Kodak film boxes. My dad wanted some extra money to grow the printing press manufacturing business called Mark Andy Incorporated. And he decided that to raise extra money, the best way to do that was to take on a label printing job for Kodak. And he developed a geared numbering head where every label that ran by, the geared printing head changed to the next higher number. And we didn't have computers back then, so all this was done mechanically with gears and number plates. And it was a fascinating machine. And I was there from the very beginning, sorting bolts by thread and by pitch, and learning the fundamentals of mechanical engineering simply by building a printing press from scratch. And it was a fascinating project. And then I became the main press operator while my uncle and my father stoked the press with paper and with label paper and ink and kept it running so that I could operate the machine at full speed. And it was a fascinating thing to be involved with, and it was an incredible education at the age of 7 years old.
I guess so. Wow, that's all right. So you had mentioned that when I first spoke to you, and I thought that was pretty fascinating. I really did. I thought, wow, what an experience that would be at that age. What an experience that would be. All right. So, all right. Later in life, as you got older, of course. Keep going.
Well, you know, I was an athlete as a teenager. I played baseball, basketball, and tennis. I wound up playing 3 sports at the collegiate level. They wore me out. you know, sometimes we had two sports in season at the same time, two practices a day. And so I often skipped my English classes and my what I call the liberal classes. And I skipped those and just took the midterm and the final. And I spent a lot of time on the athletic fields and paying for my college. And it was a great thing to do. And then I got into the engineering side of things and got recruited to be a contractor for the United States government. And I worked overseas in 1986 for Ronald Reagan. I'm 63 now, so that's been a while. But we worked on shooting down Soviet Hinds and other things to help the Afghanis and defeat the Soviets, push them back at the time.
Interesting.
Then the wall came down, and I had some other interesting projects. I guarded a Russian fighter pilot named Viktor Belenko, who escaped the Soviet Union by stealing the MiG-25. And he landed on a northern island in Japan, and we put a disguise on him, brought him over on a commercial aircraft. We hit him in Vegas, and then we hit him on a ranch in Montana, then back to Vegas, and then out to a farm in Illinois. And they had 12 KGB agents trying to find this guy and kill him because he was their chief test pilot, and he was clearly a traitor in their eyes. And that was sort of an interesting thing to get to know Viktor.
I was going to ask you, you had to have people on your tail coming after you or looking for him, that is, specifically.
Well, they had 12 KGB agents full-time assigned to kill him, to find him and kill him.
Nice. Okay.
And they got fairly close on a number of occasions. We actually found out a lot about it because years after the wall came down, I was sitting in a bar called Annie Guns with Viktor Belenko and the KGB agent that was in charge of the group trying to kill him. Now, a lot of that discussion was in Russian, but it was a fascinating evening, to say the least. And they got to chit-chat about all of their experiences and how close they came to killing him. And the good news was they no longer had orders to kill him. So they sat in a bar and talked it out. It was a fascinating thing to witness.
So, okay. Yeah, I'm just working that out in my head. Here's a guy that was ordered to kill the person that you were guarding, and now you find yourselves at a bar drinking together, basically. This is the scenario, right?
At Annie Guns in Chesterfield, Missouri, where all three of us are sitting at the bar talking about the last 10 years, and it was a fascinating night, to say the least.
It's only business. I mean, it's just business, nothing personal, right? Just, oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right. And here we are today. Now, you're head of something called the Freedom Center USA. Let's talk about that, if you don't mind. Or did we skip ahead too far?
No, the Freedom Center is fascinating. If you want to hear a funny story about Viktor, I'll tell you later. But the Freedom Center is a very unusual place. And it was conceived by four great American men that decided that the United States needed a place somewhere in the Midwest dedicated to training Americans and transferring the knowledge and skills necessary to preserve freedom in the United States of America. And so a gentleman who passed away this January, a very close friend of mine, Rick Brown, was the main impetus to this project. And he died of a heart attack early this year, and a tragic loss for us. But Rick and I looked for land for almost 10 years that we could lay out into a training facility that would ultimately be the finest place to do firearms training in the United States. And we finally found a piece of land, and it's roughly 200 acres. We have a 1,000-yard range, long rifle range there, and we have what's called a 360-degree training range. So if you can imagine a football field, roughly, 110 yards long, 40 yards wide, and 18-foot walls all the way around. And what that facility does is it allows us to do advanced training where you have threats in a 360-degree environment. And we have barricades and vehicles and multiple people, hostages, hostage targets, citizen targets, threat targets, in any and all directions, and our instructors are up on the walls supervising the training in our advanced classes. It's a fascinating thing to watch.
Wow. Okay. That would be. And as a matter of fact, a Patreon member, a member and a friend, just attended one of your classes and just said it was just the amount of information was just so tremendous, and the value that he received, the knowledge was just absolutely over the top. So you get high marks all the way around, and I people have written to me saying that you have the best training bar none in the country. So I just, you know, just saying just from what I've been seeing. So thank you for what you do. Wow. Okay. If you don't mind too, one of the issues that are not one of a main issue that's really on Americans' mind and people who listen to this program on our minds collectively and individually, of course, is where we stand right now. And we had a conversation on Saturday and I listened. And that really, I mentioned this on the show yesterday. I mentioned this to my wife. I mentioned this to Eric the Tech. I mentioned this to a couple of people I talked to yesterday. I said, you know, I talked to this amazing man this weekend, and I was referencing you, and I said, this is what he was saying was where we're at, how we got here, where we're at, and what he sees happening. And they said, oh, do tell. So I tried to tell, and I'm like, well, I can't explain it. You'll have to listen. You'll have to listen on Tuesday. So here we are. I did. Well, I'm trying to be funny a little bit, but you get the idea.
Well, sure. What a fascinating time that we live in. And, you know, as a Christian man, we live after Christ's first appearance on earth. And we live before his second coming. And there's a tension that exists between the now and the not yet. And it is the building of the kingdom and evil coexisting on this planet at the same time between those two events that cause that tension. And so how blessed are we to live in the time where we can be part of building a kingdom and confronting evil and doing the right thing every day, and promoting human rights granted by God. I mean, what a blessed time to live in. And a lot of people look at this scenario where we're at right now, and they see the difficulties, and they're correct in their observations about these difficulties. But understanding them clearly will certainly bring you peace of mind. It'll bring you direction on what you need to do for your life to prepare for these difficulties. And I think it's very important to understand objectively. You know, I used to work with a gentleman named Mark Karachi. He was a SEAL Team 6 member. He came up through UDT 11. He went to Team 6 and was a master chief for Dev Group, which is a little bit like the black side of Team 6 in certain respects. 22 years plus in Naval Special Operations, probably the wisest warrior that I ever met. Certainly one of the most proficient warriors ever to live on the planet. I would describe him as the alpha wolf of planet Earth. That is Mark Karachi. And Mark used to say that the most important thing for anyone in conflict is to be objective, is to see objectively. Don't make things more than they are. Don't make things less than they are. Let them be exactly what they are and allow them to be exactly what they are immediately. And the immediacy of that is very important. It's critical that we see clearly in these times. And so where are we in the present? Well, we're in a situation right now where we have a shadow government that is tied heavily to globalist interests, and they are trying to take over America. They're trying to take control. And then we have, citizen-wise, several types of insurgencies going on right now. And there's five phases to an insurgency. If you have sophisticated training in insurgency and counterinsurgency, you'll know what I'm talking about. But what we're mainly concerned with now are the fourth and the fifth phase. We've gotten past the first three phases of the insurgency. And so now we're in the fourth phase. The fourth phase of an insurgency is typically represented by several indicators. And the strongest indicator are attacks, random attacks on the security elements of the state. So in this situation in America, our security element are our police officers. And in a lot of countries, it's the military, but here in America, it's the police. And so understanding that when you see these random attacks on police officers, and it's never the bad or abusive cops that get attacked. It's always the good-hearted, innocent, helpful police officers that are sitting in their car drinking coffee or approachable on the street. You can walk right up to them. They want to help you. These are the people that get randomly attacked by these insurgent elements. And we see that, and that is actually the strongest indicator that we're in the fourth phase of an insurgency. The bad news is, historically, no country has ever reached the fourth phase of an insurgency and not gone full steam into the fifth phase, which is basically a shooting war. That's the part that concerns me. The reasons for that are pretty simple. When you get to the fourth phase, when you start seeing random attacks on the security elements of the government typically reflexively reacts and tightens the noose around the people. In other words, they constrict and restrict the people's rights even more and more and more. And that is typically the impetus to go headlong into the fifth phase of an insurgency. That is the motivation, the government's increasing restrictiveness on your rights, on your freedoms, that motivates the public to revolt. And this is what the insurgents are hoping for. They're hoping for a shooting war. They're hoping for violence. They're hoping to tear this country apart from the inside out. They're doing everything they can to push us to the fifth phase.
All right. So it's almost, to me, it's almost counterintuitive. We have in the executive branch a man who seems to be our greatest hope into maintaining and restoring our personal individual liberties that were taken away from us, yet we're seeing such chaos on the streets, and then we're watching the media, this collective media, blaming that man, President Trump, on everything that we're seeing. I mean, so how is it possible that we could be at this point, having won, so to speak, that last election in 2016? And what does that say for this year, if anything?
Well, that's a fascinating question. You know, we've been here before. People that remember Jimmy Carter and the 22% interest rates and the fuel rationing and the state the country was in then, and then Ronald Reagan running for president in 1979. And the Republican Party did not like Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was an outsider.
True.
They expected their man to win, and Ronald Reagan won instead. And the difference is that the shadow government is much stronger now. The foreign influence in our country is much stronger now, thanks to Bill Clinton and the Bush family as well. And so you have these international forces pouring money in to a divide and conquer strategy inside the United States. And so Trump being an outsider, Trump being a man who I would not lay claim to having any great moral framework. I would say that Trump is a guy who loves his grandchildren, and he looked at the direction the country was going, and he said, I don't want my grandchildren to grow up in an environment in the direction this country is going. I need to do something and change it. Now, Trump's imperfect on many levels, as are all human beings.
Right.
So we need to pray for him. We need to pray for his wisdom. I think when he took on the president's role, I think he was naive in the sense that he had no idea how deep the deep state government was and how strong the shadow government was. He's been battling it ever since. He's made some really poor picks in his cabinet that were clearly deep state operatives, and they were mistakes. He's also made some excellent choices. His recent nomination of Amy Coney Barrett for the Supreme Court is something he should have done with the first nomination. But, you know, he's learning. Trump's not a fool. He's a quick learner, and he's learned a lot in the last 3 years. And I'm hoping that he can do some damage to the shadow government and mitigate the violence in this country in and around and after the election.
Yeah, I am hoping as well, and hoping for a undisputed election where he is reelected. You know, I look around at the after I spoke with you, there was Joe Biden came to our town, and I looked at the crowd. I looked over the crowd, the Biden crowd, and I mean, a very small, pitiful crowd at the airport. I looked at the, also where he spoke, and I mean, even smaller still. And I compare that to Donald Trump's crowds, which they're just mind-blowingly large relative to anyone else's. Now, having said that, that doesn't necessarily indicate, you know, an election win, given the fact that there's mail-in voting fraud potential and potential fraud everywhere. So you had, and this brings me back to the conversation you and I had on Saturday, where I asked you a question. I said, where do you see this going, or where do you see the possibilities of this going? And you gave me a couple of different, I think two different paths, and both ending up, oh, not so good. In their end.
True.
You know, so if you want to address that, I'd kind of be interested in your.
Sure. Well, I see three possible paths, one of them not very likely. The least likely outcome is that Trump arrests some of these deep state criminals before the election and starts to turn the country around. I don't think he has the steam to do it. I think if he did, he would have done it before now. The two most likely scenarios, one, Trump winning the election by a landslide. The other scenario is the election is relatively close, and the Democrats claim the election isn't over the day after the election and that all the mail-in ballots have not been counted. And so they will keep counting ballots and keep having court challenges to count more ballots until they have stuffed the ballot box full enough for Biden to win in certain key states, which will give him the Electoral College victory. I think that is clearly their strategy, is to use mail-in voting and voter fraud and manufactured ballots and to lengthen the process so they can measure, assess, and then stoke in particular states until they've achieved victory. And they will use the media to pump their idea that the election is not over, that the ballots have not been counted, and that all ballots must be counted. We can't disenfranchise any voter, and they will continue to manufacture ballots until they've achieved victory. Now, in the first scenario, Trump wins in a landslide. There's already plans for paid operatives to cause mass rioting in the cities. Cities controlled by Democratic mayors or Democratic executives in a state with a Democratic governor are going to be at the highest level of risk and damage. If you're a homeowner or a business owner in a city controlled by a Democrat in a state run by a Democratic governor, I would highly suggest you get out before the election. There will be mass rioting there. If it gets too bad, then the trucks will stop bringing food and fuel into the cities. And then you will see what I like to call a locust effect, where people spend a few days without food, so they start to migrate out into the counties and take it. So if you're in the county on the edge of a large city run by Democrats, you better be in a position to defend your neighborhood. It's not enough to defend your home. You need to have like-minded neighbors that will stand with you to defend your neighborhood against a large crowd of people. You only need to look as far back as apartheid violence in South Africa to understand how this plays out. The second most likely scenario is that they steal the election. And if that's the case, they'll probably take the House and the Senate and the presidency if they're successful in their strategy. And they will keep good on their promise to confiscate rifles and to ban AR-15s in the United States by February 15th. And if that happens, we're in the middle of a war. Because Americans are not giving up their rifles. We're not playing this game ever again.
You know, when you said that to me this weekend, that resonated with me. Okay, I can see how that would play out. Of course, you'd have a Beto O'Rourke oversight of, hell yeah, we're going to take your guns. Hell yeah, we're going to take your AR-15s or whatever he did say. I'm not sure the precise verbiage, but nonetheless, I can't see, you know, that's not going to be pretty. I mean, there's no way that is going to be pretty. How in the hell, and I mean that literally because it would be, can they possibly achieve that, taking one's weapons, taking the weapons of Americans? They'd have to bring outside help in. Am I right or not?
It depends on the area. You know, America is a very large place.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons a one-size-fits-all solution for things like the coronavirus and other issues doesn't work. The genius of Thomas Jefferson in pushing decision-making down the ladder to the root base level of government was brilliant. John Adams, who was a centrist and wanted a strong federal government, was basically wrong about everything in that respect. And so when it comes to confiscating weapons, people need to understand that there are large city police departments, New Orleans, Chicago, Baltimore, Cleveland. These policemen will absolutely play the brown shirts and confiscate weapons if ordered to do so. Now, having said that, there are also conservative sheriffs in rural counties, in states across the country, that will refuse a confiscation order. Thus the difficulty of taking over America, because the only thing that stands between this takeover and our freedoms is Donald Trump and the American rifleman. And that's the simple nature of it all. And so if people take a stand and are willing to fight and not give up their rifles, the paper tiger that is the government has no chance of confiscating rifles on a massive scale. They have zero chance of accomplishing this. And people ask me, oh, well, you don't know that, or how would you know that? Well, when I worked at the Pentagon after 9/11, one of the projects that I worked on was some issues involving forces, both active and reserve. And so I'm very familiar with the numbers of active and the number of reserves that we have available. And a lot of people don't understand this about our military, is that we only have about 445,000 active military members. We have a certain number on ready reserve. We have a National Guard and reserve components that number about 1.2 million.
Let me stop right there. Just to be clear, we only have less than 500,000 active military reserves.
Yes, sir.
Of all branches.
All branches added together. Now, here's the thing that people don't understand about our military. Only about 20% of that 450,000 are actually shooters.
Okay.
Most of them are logistics. They're cooks. They're warehouse people. They're mechanics. They're not riflemen. Okay? So if you take 20% of 450,000, and then you acknowledge the simple fact that half of the shooters are deployed overseas, you don't have a lot of guns for the active military to come take weapons away from people. Now, the reserve component forces, you've got about 1.2 million. One in seven of our reserve component forces are shooters with any significant skills. Okay, so, you know, take 1.2 million and divide it by seven. Now add the 20% of the 450,000, the one out of seven for the 1.2 million. Go ahead and add 50,000 federal agents. Okay, and these people couldn't take on the deer hunters in Pennsylvania.
Right.
I mean, what are there, 5.7 million deer hunters? They couldn't take on the riflemen in Pennsylvania, much less the United States of America. So understanding the numbers and understanding clearly that the people hold the power and the wisdom of our founding fathers in the Second Amendment is absolutely critical to our survival. I mean, the genius of these founding fathers make tyranny a really hard thing to push past a certain point. So they have absolutely no chance of confiscating guns nationwide. Now, what they can do is they can concentrate the confiscation of guns in one state and try and make examples out of everyone and go state to state. But here's the thing. The word will get out. And when the word gets out that they're killing Americans to take their guns, this current regime is done. And whoever's running it will be hung high in a tree on pay-per-view.
Hmm. Wow. Okay.
Now, there's better news, Doug, because about 90% of our Marines will not follow orders to confiscate guns or shoot Americans.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. All right.
The Marines will not take unconstitutional orders. Now, there's probably 40 to 60% of the Army, depending on what unit, that will obviously play brown shirts and follow and execute unconstitutional orders. But the good news is the 1.2 million in the National Guard, most of our National Guardsmen and reservists, they're older gentlemen. They understand the Constitution. They understand their oath. They will not follow unconstitutional orders to attack the American people. And so a lot of these collectivists that have been running this this insurgency in America, they're in for some real surprises as they try and execute their plan. And it'll be a fascinating thing to watch.
And you were, if I may bring this up, by the way, I'm running these numbers, and it gives you a little different flavor. When you do run the numbers like you've given, it gives you a little bit of different flavor to me anyway. When you listen to others talk, obviously you know what you're talking about. You've got the numbers, you've got the figures to, that you're providing. So you can at least in my view, provide a more accurate scenario. But one thing that you said, because, you said that, there are some brown shirts in the, there will be some brown shirts in the, police departments and such, especially in the, that follow the orders. And, you had personal experience of this. I think you said in Ferguson.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes. We put a group of people together in 2014. My wife was reading a story about Natalie of Natalie's Cakes and More in Ferguson, and her business during the riots was destroyed. They broke her windows. They stole her mixing machine that was her main tool for baking, and they basically ruined her business. And my wife looked at me and said, "You can help this woman. You need to put together some of your friends and go up to Ferguson and protect these people and protect her and protect those people in the apartments above her." And I said, "Woman, you have no idea what you're asking me to do. I will see you in a month if I go do this, maybe." And she said, "That's fine. I'll be here when you get back." And so we put together a team of Marines and SF guys and some police officers, and we protected a block of buildings north of the firehouse and the police station where the main violence was. And there were small businesses. There was a lawyer's office. There was a large dental office. The main dental care for the city of Ferguson was there. And there was Natalie's Cakes and More. There was a very large beauty supply shop. There was a Chinese restaurant on the north end. There was a Savoy building across the street and a hardware store across the street. And our men protected these buildings for the better part of 3 weeks. And we were attacked by arsonists. We were attacked by protesters, but we repelled those attacks. We put out the Molotovs. We basically had fuel fire extinguishers and buckets of water on the roof. What they were doing was throwing Molotov cocktails onto the flat tar roofs of these 2- and 3-story buildings. And then they were breaking the glass and they were throwing Molotovs into the lower areas and catching the building on fire. And these Molotovs would basically burn to the center and collapse the building. They did over $70 million worth of damage. The police and the Democrat governor, Nixon, allowed over $72 million worth of arson damage to be done to the city of Ferguson. And that's what happens when you have a rhino Republican mayor and a libtard governor, Democrat. And then the Department of Justice can then come into the unified command meetings and thumb down policy and basically order your officers to stand down and not protect the city and not do the jobs they were paid to do. And so here we found ourselves in Ferguson doing the policeman's job because the chief, Belmar, and the head of the highway patrol, Replogle, didn't have the gonads to stand up to the governor and the White House and tell them we are going to do our jobs. They refused to do that. And they took these illegal orders and stood down and allowed these people to destroy the city. And we protected a small block of the city, not a lot of the city, just about 7 buildings. But not a dollar's worth of damage was done to the buildings we protected with the strategy that we used. And on Friday, a week after, basically 5 days after the violence began, we found ourselves surrounded with over 60 St. Louis County police officers and with a handful of highway patrolmen. And they were telling us that they to come down off the rooftops to stop protecting these buildings and that they were going to arrest us and confiscate our guns. Well, I told Lieutenant Hoots at the time, Lieutenant, you've got a really failed strategy here because, one, we're not coming down off the rooftops. Two, we're not giving you our guns. Three, you're on private property. Four, you have no warrant. And five, you need to get the hell out of here before you cause a problem you can't fix. And Hoots said, oh, no, we're going to arrest you guys. We're going to take your guns. And I said, no, you're not. Turn around and look behind you, Hoots. What do you see? And he turned around and he said, well, those are my men. And I said, well, you see men. I see young guys with shiny badges and pistols. Now look on the rooftop, sir. What do you see up there? He goes, well, those are your men. I said, no, those are men with 4 to 5 tours of duty in the sandbox with semi-auto suppressed weapons and full auto suppressed weapons. And this thing will be over in 10 seconds and every drop of blood will be on your name because you're the highest ranking person in this parking lot. So I'd highly suggest you call your boss and come up with a different strategy. So he called Tim Tanner and Tim Tanner gets on the phone and says, Sam, what are you doing? I knew Tim from St. Louis County when he worked in tactical operations. And I said, Tim, you need to come up with a different strategy. Talk to your boss. Said, I'll tell you what, if you put policemen on the rooftops with firemen to protect these buildings, I'll pull my men out. He said, I can't do that. I said, well, then you need to tell your boss to come up with a different strategy because we're not going anywhere. And you guys are on private property with no warrant and nobody's broken the law here and we know it. And we've got police officers, commissioned police officers here with us. So you got a problem. He said, Sam, you can't do this. This goes all the way to the top. I said, well, then call the chief and have a chat with him. He says, not the chief, all the way to the White House. You guys need to leave. I said, not going to happen. I said, over my dead body.
All the way to the White House. Okay.
Yeah, and the White House, Valerie Jarrett, had sent a DOJ attorney to come down and threaten Chief Belmar and tell him if he didn't follow every order they gave him, that they were going to remove him as chief and federalize the St. Louis County Police Department. That's exactly what happened, and that's exactly what went down in Ferguson. And the media never told the true story of Ferguson.
As a matter of fact, this goes back to what you were initially saying, which is I'm glad you we had the chance to kind of talk about the machines, the printing machines and such, because what happened with the newspaper reports about that?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, that's a fascinating story in itself. A lot of liberals believe that the media tells the truth. Well, they don't want to admit that the government controls the media. And they say, oh, Sam, you have no proof of that. And I say, oh, yes, I do. I've got clear and concise proof of that. So let's talk about the timing of Saturday night in Ferguson, the Saturday after Thanksgiving in 2014. So they came the first night on Friday night and told us to leave. We told them no. Then the second night they show up and they say you have to leave a second time. Of course, we tell them no. Okay. Well, now we're in a 3.5 hour standoff with the Highway Patrol and the St. Louis County Police in Missouri, in the city of Ferguson. Well, here's the thing. We have a newspaper in St. Louis called the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It's the largest circulating newspaper in Missouri. If you're going to print a story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, you basically have to be edited and typeset by about 11 p.m. If you're ready to go before 11 o'clock, then you'll make the first print that comes out around 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning. That's the first run of that paper for that day. And so here we are. The police don't even show up until 11:40 in the evening and tell us to leave. We're in a 3-hour standoff with them to after 3 o'clock in the morning. And at 4 a.m., the first print of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch comes out, and the headline on the front page says, St. Louis County Police kick militiamen, Oath Keepers off the rooftops of Ferguson and kick them out of Ferguson. And this is the headline in the paper. We never left. We were there the whole time in a standoff with the police. We came the next night and the next night and the next night for 3 weeks and protected those buildings. And the story was a complete, total fabricated lie. So how is it possible that a credible newspaper would print a story that actually never happened at all? And the answer to that is the federal government told them exactly what to print. Unfortunately for them, it never happened because we didn't follow their direction, their instructions, or pay any attention to their threats. And we held our ground and we stood there armed and told them to kiss our you-know-what.
And there's a little bit something else wrong with that headline, too. You weren't part of the Oath Keepers, right? Or were you?
I wasn't part of the Oath Keepers. There were a few Oath Keepers there. You know, they called us Oath Keepers because Stuart Rhodes was calling all the media, trying to generate media for his organization and raise money, which he did very effectively, and then stole the money from his own organization. But, you know, the interesting thing is that they tried to label us. The police were telling the protesters we were KKK. Don't go over by those buildings. We can't protect you. Those guys are KKK. I had 9 different races of men in my protection detail, and they were calling us KKK.
KKK. Yeah, 9 different. Okay, it's amazing. All right. My goodness. But okay, so that – now, because of the time, and I want to have you back if you'll come back, because I got a million more questions. Including before we dismiss our time together here, I want to make sure I know how that we talk about how people can help you, and now how people can help your wife, knowing what she does. But before we get into that, what's going on in Portland? What's going on in Seattle? What's going on in Michigan? Elsewhere? Where in the hell are guys like you? Where is everyone? They're toppling statues. They're burning buildings. They're looting stores. Why aren't what the hell's wrong with us? Sorry, but I'm a little bit peeved.
No, I think that's a good question. But you have to understand that the American patriot now is past protesting and standing guard. Everybody's loading ammo and sharpening their knives right now, and they're getting ready for the big one. And so everybody's decided that, you know, we're just going to sit back and let this thing devolve. And when it's time to go to war, we're going to go to war. And so you don't see the protests. You don't see the Christians. And, you know, part of the problem is we have a lot of anesthetized Christians in this country. They go sit in church and they listen to denominational norms being preached from the pulpit instead of reading their Bible and reading the words in red and understanding what Christ taught as truth. And so the truth will set you free. Sitting and listening to a preacher talk about denominational norms isn't going to do a whole lot for you. And, you know, there's the myth of the passive Jesus that pervades Christianity in America and in the churches. Well, I want to remind people that Jesus Christ built his own scourge, the most feared weapon of his day, made it himself, went into the temple, his father's house, and whipped people and drove them out and turned their tables over. So the myth of the passive Jesus is just that, a myth. Christ expects people to stand up for truth, to stand up for what's right, and to oppose evil. And if you don't have enough spine to do that, perhaps you should get Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book, Ethics, and read that, and maybe you'll grow a spine. But understand what Christ did and who he was, and that his whole purpose on earth is to defeat evil. And we should be helping that purpose. We should be contributing and doing our part. And so I think, to answer your question specifically, people are waiting. They're saving their ammo. They're loading more ammo. They're buying more ammo. I mean, you can hardly find ammo for sale anywhere in the country anymore.
That's true.
And so obviously people are getting ready. And when the people that didn't want to get involved, guys like me that just want to stay on the sidelines and resolve this peacefully, when we get involved, it's going to get really ugly, and we're going to take care of business, and we won't have to do this for another 100 years. We're going to make sure we're not doing this every 4 years.
It restores my faith in men. It restores my faith in movement for freedom, or the maintaining freedom, to hear you say that and to talk with you about that. I'll tell you right now. And I believe that. I believe it's going to be a quick mop-up operation of these Muppets out there who are, who think that they're, you know, that they can push their utopian or collective utopianism. No. Collectivism. Utopian collectivism. I'll get it right. On us. And, you know, so yeah, I think they're in for a big surprise. And one of the last questions here before we get into how we can best help is, I had asked you why we haven't seen this pushback yet, and you partially answered it now, but you said something, and I copied it down from this weekend, but you said something that just kind of stuck with me. You know, why haven't we seen somebody at this point take out one of these high profile Marxists, or why haven't we seen, I think that the way I asked the question is, why haven't we seen like a death wish scenario kind of play out, where you've got a Paul Kersey going out and, you know, in the shadows and then disappearing back into the shadows after taking care of business. And you said something, and do you remember what you said?
Well, I think there's two reasons. I'm sure one of them will hit what you're talking about. The first reason is guys like George Soros, they hire ex-Navy SEALs, ex-Secret Service guys for their protection detail. And they're pretty slick about how they move around, and they're surrounded by really highly trained armed men. So it takes a pretty sophisticated operator to take one of those guys out successfully and live to tell about it. Now, the second thing is, a lot of people don't really realize that behavior is very strongly tied to chemistry. And the American diet causes cortisol levels to rise in the American male, estrogen levels to rise. And, you know, our intelligence agencies have done a lot of studies on this. And I'm going to reveal, try and summarize quickly the results. So you have men with normal testosterone levels and lower cortisol levels. And when they're attacked or aggressed, they respond and fight back. Then you have men that have normal testosterone levels and high cortisol levels. And when these men are attacked, when they're aggressed, they don't respond and fight back. They either freeze or they flee. And then you have men with low testosterone levels, high estrogen levels, and also high cortisol levels. And so these people are even worse. When they're aggressed, they generally freeze or fawn. They don't know what to do. They shut down completely. They dissociate, or they begin the fawn process, which is actually the early stages of Stockholm syndrome. And so understanding that chemistry in the American male has a tremendous effect on your response to being abused or aggressed is really important. And men need to research how to get their cortisol levels down. Most men already make enough testosterone, but cortisol blocks your body from absorbing the testosterone and using it properly, and it changes the way that your brain decides to react to different scenarios. And so getting your cortisol levels down, getting your estrogen levels back to normal, your testosterone's probably fine. You're probably not low T. You're probably high cortisol. And understanding this and understanding your dietary choices and how that affects you has a profound effect on your behavior as an American male. And so I would highly recommend that you all research that and figure out how to get your cortisol levels lower, because behavior is very strongly tied to your body chemistry.
All right. You know, I've told folks that I sat next to and interviewed Tom Homan, who was he was the head of U.S. Customs and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and he testified before Congress. Tom Homan was he'd eat you for lunch and you know, just laugh as he burped you up. But here's a guy, Sam Andrews, who I think is on par with Tom Homan, and really. Yeah, I sent a team over to measure his testosterone levels. The team reported back that Sam broke the equipment and broke a couple of the guys. And anyway, I
have very normal testosterone, but I also have low cortisol levels. So, yeah. And that's by design. I work very hard at eating the right things.
Well, it's fascinating because I think you tied everything together here, and I so appreciate your time because we covered a lot of ground, and I just want to make this kind of an introduction into you with our audience and those people who you don't know you necessarily, but now they do. And I think they've got a really good, clear picture and understanding of who you are. And I'll tell you some of the folks, he is a gentleman that, I have a lot of respect for. And I know that, you also build high-end weaponry. Is that a fair statement?
We do.
Okay. So
we do. We have 3,000 yard sniper weapon systems that we build. We build long range elk hunting rifles. We build the best CQB rifles in the world, close quarter battle AR-15s that are piston operated, and they're high-tech metallurgy, high-tech coatings. You can run them dry. You need no lubrication, and they'll run like a sewing machine, completely dry. They're amazing pieces of equipment. But, you know, one of these days I hope we get a chance to talk at length about the false belief systems that keep Americans from – preparing for what's coming in this country.
I'd love to.
And
yes,
and I think that would be a fascinating thing to talk about is you know, like we have so many deer hunters here in Lebanon, Missouri, and they're riflemen and they're good with their deer hunting rifle. They don't generally miss a deer when they get a shot, but they don't understand that you need training to learn how to fight something that shoots back. And you need specific training for these things, and these false belief systems will keep you from doing the right thing and get the information out.
Okay, we'll have you back with your permission, and as your schedule permits, we'll have you back. And
yes, sir.
I appreciate. By the way, can you send me information about your wife, and perhaps we can have her on as well if she would like that. And also,
absolutely, I will certainly do that. And Mr. Hagman, thank you for having me. I hope you have a blessed week, sir.
It's Doug, and thank you, sir. Appreciate it. My goodness, wow, folks, wasn't that great? I mean, it was fantastic. Sam Andrews, going to be right back. You're listening to the Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network. Stay right where you're at.
Mainstream media won't. You're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network. Thank you.
to Hagman. This is the Hagman Report, where truth can't be silenced. During the break. Oh my goodness. Eric the Tech is just, he's Eric the Tech. Gotta love him, you know. Speaking of loving, people, Stan and Holly Dale, I mean, they are institutions in this country, in the world. I would bet that if you go to, Savile Row in the UK, in London, and say Stan and Holly Dale, they'd say, yeah, Stan was just in here buying a suit. Holly was buying some, stole. Or in the Outback, wherever, or even anywhere here in the United States, people know who Stan and Holly Dale are. Holly Dale, of course, the author of Dare to Prepare and, Prophetic Perils and so many other items. If you go to standeo.com, that's standeo.com, you'll find everything there, as well as their Patreon account where you can support them and be part of their meetings, and their Patreon, work, as well as the headlines that Holly puts up. She doesn't sleep. Somebody, pokes her with a stick every couple of hours and says, hey, you got to get up and, do the headlines on the website. I think Stan does that. Rumor has it. Anyway, it's a great website, standeo.com. That's DEYO, standeo.com. And also the EMP Shield. Folks, let me tell you something. The closer we get to whatever's coming, the more I realize, a requirement is the EMP Shield. It's EMPShield.com. That's EMPShield.com/Hagman. That's two N's on Hagman. And that will get you $50 off of a unit. And people will say, well, why do I need one of these if the entire grid's going to be fried and everything's going to be fried? Well, that's not the case. The entire grid's not going to be fried necessarily. Some will be geographically specific, others in other scenarios. The grid is hardened. And don't you want to take care of your electronics if you have that ability? Of course you do. Okay, so there you go. EMPShield.com/Hagman for an extra $50 off. And Stan is the brainchild behind that, along with his team, others as well. He's the guy. He's the guy. And speaking of the guy, it's been a couple of weeks because of problems that we've had. And it's my fault. So folks, please don't throw anything at me. The studio audience is like ready to throttle me. The guy
took a bat to all my equipment.
They did, right? Because of lack of Stan. Lack of Stan.
Yep.
That's right.
Yeah, they showed up and.
No. So Stan Deo, how are you, sir?
But, I'm not suffering from lack of Stan. Is that some kind of a new disease or what?
Well, it is here at the Hagman, not only just the Hagman household and the Hagman studio, but the Hagman audience. And I've heard about it. So,
you know, you were saying about, time we've done together and how far reaching it is that people might know about me. I don't know for sure, how far away, but it's only because of your show here. We reach, gosh, I don't know how many nations you reach, but I get emails from all over the world. In fact, a couple of years back, if you recall, I got an email from a guy sitting on a stump out in the middle of China. Well, actually, north of there in an oil field. And he was typing on his iPad saying, look, I listened to the show and here's some information I can help you with. And, okay. But, it was in Mongolia. That's where it was exactly. But that's wow. And I think that's the longest reach I've had an email from.
So, folks, we're listened to in Mongolia. And hello to everyone there.
I can just picture the guy sitting out there with a hat on the sun and talking to us from there. He was an engineer out there with an oil company, but it's fun. Wow. And by the way, I don't poke Holly with a stick to get her up in the morning because I'm not even conscious at that time.
No, but I'll tell you what, folks, she does a great job. You have to admit, and I hope you do bookmark standeo.com as a website for the headlines, the news of the day, of course, the video, the joke of the day. I mean, it's a fabulous website to start your day off with. Do that. You don't need Drudge. You don't need any of that stuff. So it's standeo.com. Mm-hmm. That's the place to go. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for that. Look, I've got so many things to talk about today. We're not going to get through all of them. I'm going to first look at some of the things affecting our weather and volcanoes and earthquakes. On our show images page, if you'll click to slide 52 and click on the picture first. Let me just do that too. Okay. And that should bring up three images of the South Pole, Antarctica. Mm-hmm. Now, there's one from July the 1st, which is at the top, and then one in the middle there from September 22nd of this year. So in less than 3 months, an ozone hole opened up. It is absolutely huge. You can see that in the September 22nd image there, the one in the middle. And if you scoot down, one, Eric, there you go. That's the hole that we see now. And the first one you were showing him was how it was about 3 months ago. It was almost invisible. There was no ozone hole to speak of over the Antarctica. If you go down to the bottom to the combination of the two, what I've done is I've used Photoshop to subtract the differences to show what actually changed over that three-month period. And right in the middle, you can see that ozone hole just opened up and covered the entire continent of Antarctica. Now, you think, well, okay, that's neat. That's pretty. What's the deal? When the ozone hole opens up, it allows cosmic radiation to get in to the Earth. Now, when it's up in the equatorial regions, you know, we'll get on the surface of the Earth, it will get burns from UV and stuff if you had a hole like that open up over, say, the United States, because that's getting UV from the sun. But we get UV and gamma radiation, all kinds of frequencies from all over the universe striking the planet. So down here at the South Pole, it's getting hit with radiation that normally the magnetic field, the atmosphere would shield us from. The ozone layer particularly, obviously, but there are a lot of things happening at the South Pole now. The ice is melting. There are things coming visible that have been hidden for ages and ages. And so I started investigating, you know, some of the things that might be surfacing there. And a fellow sent me a screen snap off of his video from, it's in slide 64. If you look at that and click on it, slide 64, it's going to show you at the top image a picture of what he calls a 60-foot diameter disc coming out of the snow and hidden underneath the land there. Now, I want to show you this because it's not exactly, as he says, it's not a UFO, it's not a 60-foot diameter crab. I went to Google Earth myself and snapped these two pictures. And at the top, you'll see that thing there next to the yellow pin. That looks like if you were looking at an angle at a disc. But that is a flat over the top, that overhead shot straight down. There's no, you know, perspective warp or bending of that disc to make it look like, you know, an ellipse. That is an elliptical shape. If you look closely, if you hit the magnifying glass and zoom it up, Eric, on that flying saucer or disc or whatever he calls it, yeah, just you have to hit over where the yellow pin is. Not there yet.
Yeah, we're trying. We've got different operating systems here than.
Okay. Well, so. Right. Okay. Anyway, you need to see that image because it's a zoomed up image of that quote unquote 60-foot diameter disc. I like to check all these things out when I get them and see if there's any way that it's misinterpreted. And in that particular picture, if you click on ours, if we have a magnifying glass, we put it over that yellow pin and click, we get a zoom up of that disc. And we need to be able to do that, Eric, so I can point out something. Can you just put your magnifying glass over that?
Yeah, he's trying right now.
Okay. Well, anyway, when we get to that, you'll see that this is a formation in the ice. I checked the altitude of that disc-looking thing versus the yellow pin, which is over land there at Antarctica. And there's no difference in the height, like 435 feet off of sea level. So how do you have a landmass with only no difference in height to the alleged UFO in the ice, having the same depth? In other words, it's saying that this phenomenon is at shoreline level with the dirt, with the soil. That's it. There you go. And you can see for yourself, you're looking at that's not an object. It can't be an object. There's no depth to it. It's the same height as the shoreline. So then I started looking around saying, well, okay, look at the rim of that alleged saucer thing. It shows depth in the ice rim. It's like water was melting from, you know, from heat underneath the landmass and out into that snow melt. So if you look at a very subtle white arc at the bottom of that disc shape or ellipse shape in this case, you'll see that something has been melting from beneath and the heat is spreading out over the rim, and gradually that'll be a big thing. But to prove my point, if you'll zoom back out of that now, Eric, and go to the second photograph underneath it, what, there's another pin. I looked about 100 miles from there in the Antarctic territory, looking for similar type shapes and holes that are formed naturally. They're not disks or anything else. If you can click on that yellow pin and zoom it up, you'll see three holes, maybe four actually, that are formed in a snowmelt area there where it iced over and the area is heating up. Don't know whether that has anything to do with the ozone layer, but you'll see that these holes share similar characteristics. Yeah, just zoom right up there in the middle of that. You can see it up close. There's similar characteristics to the alleged disc over on the other photo we're looking at. But you can see the edge of it has lighter grays of the depth of the ice. In this case, the ice is much deeper. And so you get a number of these white rings, arcs coming down.
Just a programming note. This is as zoomed in as we can go without crashing the broadcasting software.
That's fine. Yeah. So if you see the big white mound where the yellow pin is, to the left of that, you have three, maybe four holes that are melting, and they're giving you this gradation of color from the top down to the bottom where it's just dark, which they've melted the ice there, and it's just now water. So I wanted to show that difference. You can get off of that now, Eric, so that you don't blow your system up. But you can go to the video. The guy talks about it and says it's a disc and all that, but it's not really. As I say, I like to check these things out because if they were a 60-foot diameter craft, that would be interesting. But it's not. It's a natural phenomenon where the heat from underneath is melting to form that kind of elliptical melt in the middle of that ice flow. Again, with the cosmic radiation and stuff, we can also get other things from deep space. Not as high as infrared from the sun, but other things that would be absorbed by the water in the land, increasing the heat and thus melting more of the ice.
You know, I can see, though, how somebody would look at that and say, well, that looks like a man-made structure. And okay. I can see that, but okay.
All right.
But by the way, I real quick, how people, I took a picture when I was doing some surveillance. This is, oh my goodness, it was on film, you know, about 35 millimeter film. I took a still photograph, and I swore there was something in this picture. When I had the developer look at it, he said, no, that's not what you think it is. I won't get into the story, but the bottom line is, sometimes a natural formation is just a natural formation. Okay. Not that I needed to add that, I guess, but.
Yeah. Whatever, but it's okay. Yeah. You know, this UFO business is gaining traction now in the fake news or mainstream media, whatever you want to call it. Look at slide 62. This is a link to a trailer called Phenomenon. Now, James Fox was the producer of this. I did a spot on one of his shows as well a year or two back now. But he's interviewing in this a number of very notable, very respectable, former politicians or military people, whatever, CIA, about the cover-up of the UFO situation. Now, I put that link there for you to go see, because I think it's worth even looking at the trailer to see how the genre is moving into mainstream. I know it is because in slide 61, we have, if you click on the picture, we have a picture of President Trump. And why do we have a flying saucer in that picture with President Trump? Because he says he's going to take a really good, strong look at whether UFOs exist. Now, for the President of the United States to come out, that's going to be mainstream to me, talking about UFOs and a strong look at it and that kind of thing. Gradually, the consciousness of this country and perhaps the world that watch our news and media is being raised to see that we have, aliens present or some UFO thing that even if the President of the United States is looking into it, that must be serious. And I expect this to continue for weeks, months, days until the actual revealing of the alien presence, which I think will be Satan and his minions, but that revealing takes place. And at that time, they're going to, the head of that group is going to select a person here on Earth to run the world government to make peace between all the nations, and whoever he selects is going to be the Antichrist. And we may know that from other things about, agreements being signed between Israel and the neighboring Muslim nations, but we are getting very, very close to that. Now, if we are, that means very close to the world coming unzipped in the Great Tribulation.
Yeah, that doesn't, I mean, it's good. Well, it's good and bad. I mean, it's good. Obviously, we know how the book ends. The story ends for those of us who believe in Jesus Christ. We get that, but, there's a lot of bumps in the road. Back to that picture, if I can just ask you this and settle this, because I know people are going to be asking this question. Why couldn't Donald Trump pick up the phone and say, "Hey, Mark," this defense secretary, "Mark, Mr. Esper, hey, it's Don. How you doing? How was lunch? How's your wife? How the kids? Hey, can you do me a favor? can you give me the package on all UFO stuff? You know, why couldn't he do that?"
I'm sure he has. There's going to be a gradual release of this information, and it's got to look like, well, you know, didn't know about this as, you know, President Trump. I called the Secretary of Defense, and I'm now looking at stuff, and I've seen some very impressive videos from the Navy, and he's done all this already. And it's going to be a gradual release so that it's not conspiratorial, but reasons will be given for why.
All right.
You know, it's just a gradual rollout to try to save face for the government, but it's not going to work. The rollout will occur, and people will realize that we have been invaded or joined by beings that are from not around here with advanced technologies. Now, people are already losing faith in the United States, particularly, but in London or in England as well, of their governments and the secrets they keep and the jobs they're doing or not doing. And COVID-19 hit all the major nations. And so the people of all the major nations are not happy because they're suffering, their jobs are being lost, companies are folding up, people dying. And so if you were to ask the man in the street in China or Russia or here, or, you know, France, are you happy with your government? The answer is going to be no. Now, I know that one of the prerequisites for setting up the world government that was put in the book, you know, ages ago for the plan for this is the people of the nations have to lose faith in their elected or dictatorial leadership. They have to lose faith in the human leadership on this planet. At that point, they're going to be ready for, you know, a non-aligned, non-affiliated, no baggage type group of people coming from off the planet with advanced technology who must have obviously solved all the problems of peaceful government, you know, and taking care of the people. So they're going to offer a solution to a world full of people that are saying, can someone stop this, you know, fix the disease stuff and all this bickering and political stuff all over the planet and wars. We've got nuclear wars on the verge over in the Middle East. Can someone stop all this? And that's when the Antichrist gets endorsed by Satan and his minions coming as our quote-unquote elder brothers from space who've been watching over, as they say, for centuries. And were even present at the crucifixion that could give you visual proof of that. So this is where we're headed. And I've been telling people about this from about 1978, in lectures, in books, in videos, and, you know, appearances on TV. It's coming to a head now. This is the time that I've been warning about so many years ago. And this is why I pay attention to the rollout.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. It's amazing how we, just to think back, I know that we're short on time, or I don't want to take too much of your time, but I just think back of the Art Bell days, of Coast to Coast AM Art Bell days, talking about disclosure and, you know, that whole mindset back then. Of course, it had some mystique when you're listening to it at 2-3 in the morning, but, you know, from the high desert and all that. But nonetheless, it's the same now. It's closer today than ever before, and I agree with you, and I think that we're going to be met with this information that's really going to turn things on its ear for those people who will believe it wholesale. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. There's another thing here. Down slide 43. Click on the text of that. in this time of, you know, people depending on science and, you know, proof of various things in the world, when you look at the issue of is there a God or not and various other things in our existence and the ads and things like that, it kind of is lopsided because the presentation is, well, is God a reality? You know, it's a fiction of our, you know, mass hallucination of the human mind. We always have to have somebody greater to blame things on or to get gifts from or whatever. This film here is, you can see the trailer. It's called Against the Tide, Finding God in an Age of Science. Now, Kevin Sorbo here is involved in producing this, and he talks with Oxford professor Dr. John Lennox. My tongue is getting in the way. Anyway, they made a beautiful documentary here, and if you're going to witness to people who are not believers, this is a great witness tool. Go see this, you know, and view it, and have your friends and family who aren't believers, or even if they are, look at this. It's encouraging to see that we have someone from Hollywood, and Sorbo, actually defending God and showing, you know, the existence of God and how it doesn't really, you know, ruin science or anything. It agrees with science in so many ways. And I've said that myself. When I went after the Garden of Eden, it was to prove to me and to others that there is a Garden of Eden. The shell of it might be there. You know, the beautiful trees and plants and stuff aren't quite so beautiful anymore, but I found the actual location by following the biblical clues. So Sorbo and his team there, they are doing the same thing, looking at data, scientific data, that prove that the Bible is correct and that God is not dead. You know, it's kind of cool to have Sorbo do this because he used to play Hercules, you know, the strong guy. It's all in the memory banks there. But, you know, sorry, I had to shut that off. My TV just came on. Anyway, go see that, read it, share it with people. The purpose of our show here, as far as I'm concerned, is always to witness for Jesus and for God.
Amen. Amen. And thank God for that. I'm glad. Thanks for pointing that out. I would not have known about it had I not seen that earlier. I don't know why, but I'm glad. Thank you.
Okay. All righty. You're welcome, sir. Let me see if there's anything else in that UFO type thing. Okay. Well, slide 44, you know, you can see there that they had a bunch of bright lights in Philadelphia. I think it is Philadelphia. Yeah. Pennsylvania. Anyway, UFO sightings there that you can look at. And while we're on the subject of UFOs and how they work.
By the way, this is in my backyard, so I just want to let you know that.
Did you see anything?
No. Of course, yeah. I didn't look. And I'm not trying to be funny. I didn't look. And a lot of times people don't look up. And
well, that's true.
That's one of my, I'll tell you what, in investigating crime scenes, that's one rule I have. Always look up.
Well, things are looking up, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Depends on your point of view, of course.
Depends on how far down you are.
yes.
But no, it's, but no, I'm being serious about this. When I look at a crime scene or if I'm called to consult on a crime scene, you always look above your head. A lot of people don't do that. It's amazing what you can see. But in this case, look in the sky. And a lot of people don't do that. So.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if you've seen a number of these dramas or, you know, dramatizations of murder scenes and things like that in various shows, there'll be blood spatter up on the ceiling, you know, from somebody was murdered or the throat was cut or whatever. But it's the crime scene has a three-dimensional aspect, top, sides, bottom, you know, all that. You have to take it into consideration.
That's right.
I agree. So that's look up, folks. Look up.
Look up. Yeah, doggone it.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Slide 41 was an interesting one. It's about radiation levels on the sun. Oh, sorry, on the moon. I didn't know this, but apparently the radiation levels there are really hazardous, about 200 times what safe is on the surface of the moon. Now, I knew that there was radiation, you know, because there's no atmosphere and the sun is shooting at it, you know, little particles of everything and deep space cosmic radiation is hitting it. But astronauts would get between 200 and 1,000 times more radiation on the moon than what we experience here on the Earth. And that's about 5 to 10 times more than passengers on a transatlantic airline flight receive. You know, so
wow.
When they build houses up there for astronauts, they're going to, you know, occupy a base. They're talking about using lunar dust, mixing it with other chemicals and water that they now know where they can get it on the moon, and have robots, you know, build 3D, you know, like print 3D accommodations for the astronauts that are going to live there. They can make them about, well, I think it's 12 to 18 inches thick, but they don't want to make it any thicker because if they do, the dirt of the shield of the house, in other words, the dirt will start emitting radiation at a level that's compromising them. All these things you have to take into consideration. You can't make the walls too thick because the dirt that you're using will be, you know, concentrated radiation. But if you make it just right, it'll shield you from the external radiation on the floor, looking down, and on the roof looking up, and on all four sides. So there you go, a little article about what you didn't know about on the moon.
I just realized how little I know. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of what I felt, too, yeah. Absolutely. I've been in that game for a long time, didn't realize it was that hard, you know, that the radiation. Okay, now down at the bottom, I have slide 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42. Okay, not 41, 42. Okay, what I'm looking at here is something called the Kwanda effect for making saucer-shaped aircraft. Now, over 100 years ago, Henri Kwanda invented and built models of what you'll see in slide 42 of saucer shapes that blow air out under a lid over the rest of the shape of the craft, and the air sticks to, you know, it conforms to the shape of that saucer and goes around underneath and forms a pressure area underneath it. Now, this is called the Kwanda effect because the air comes out the top, you know, under that lid there, and it follows the surface around and curves in underneath to form a pressure area under the craft, but also a low pressure area over the top of it. Now, why is that interesting? Well, one of the places that some of my work has been posted is on Gael Nadin's scientific site in France. And he has built and tested a form of the Kwanda craft. Now, you don't need to go and get the videos right this moment, but down underneath there, slides 37 through 39, you have videos of Jean-Louis testing of the Kwanda effect saucer that he made to test the Kwanda effect. And I got to tell you, when you see what this little craft does, just with air blowing over the surface of it, you've got to be impressed. It is really, really impressive. This thing maneuvers very rapidly and turn on a dime. And this is just an aircraft, not a gravitic craft using the magnetic and gravitic fields of the Earth. This is a simple aircraft that you can do yourself. And he does on these websites tell you, let's see, on the slide 39, you can go to the website. Yeah, the slide 41, the picture is an image, and then the first one, 37, those two on the sides there give you instructions, component size, and number thereof. Don't know that I've got, no, I don't think I've got a picture of that. Wait a second, I might have it here. Just give me a second here. I'm going to look for a picture.
While you're doing that, I was looking at this and it says, Kwanda effect aerial vehicles in the U.S. after 1945, a number of experimental saucer shaped craft were apparently developed as a black project by Lockheed for the U.S. Air Force. And I thought I said Corvair for the CIA because I remember the Corvair from the 60s, but no, Convair for the CIA. Very interesting about the designs. Folks, definitely click on the link to this. My goodness. And then drawings on dated 1970.
Good, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm looking for it. Yeah, I made a design and started following the patent information together for a version of this craft, which incorporates what's called a VIA, or vertical insertion acceleration, VIA drive. And behind me, if you look at this, let me just see if I can get out of the way here. I'm doing it. Hold on. Look behind me there. That's this side you want to see.
Look at you.
This is a cross section of the device here. Let's see. My hand is moving backwards, so kind of weird, but okay. You can see that. There you go. Right. That is a cutaway, a cross section of the Kiwanda Craft with Stanley's edition. Now, the yellow dots and little arrows show you that you have a device down inside there, say in the middle where my hand is here. And that device is like a turbofan, that, like Nadine's device did. It blows the air up underneath that cupola at the top there, that kind of weird-looking gray thing at the top. And it blows it there and then over the wing, and I can go that way, can't I? Right. Now, instead of just having the Kiwanda effect, which would be this portion of the wing here, okay, I have some of that air being recirculated because it's being sucked in by the fan here and going up and over. So it's using part of the air that is being shoved over the wing to make the Kiwanda effect and recirculating because it's moving energy, which reduces the amount of energy your fan has to do to produce this motion. There are there is one thing that's an engineering nightmare, but it's because of the as you start to move your craft, it increases the flow of the air over the wing. And if you got to recirculate like that, it'll put back pressure on your turboprops and stall them. So there was an engineering nightmare to solve, which I did do. But this is combining the Kiwanda effect with the entrainment effects, what it's formerly called the entrainment effect. Anyway, so it is something that that I've been working with in the past, and I'm happy with it. That's good. Here we go.
And that relates to the last, I think, the last time that we were together, you had talked about that, it was the craft that you, I don't recall what you called it, but same thing.
Yeah, the VIA drive, VIA, vertical insertion accelerator.
There you go. Okay, yeah, that's right. That's right. Very interesting.
VIA drive. Lord. Right. Well, I do have fun on my off time here, you know.
Wow.
I'm going to show you. Here's another one. You can pull that back out on that. And that's the one that I was designing to actually do just like Nadine's with a prop at the top. You can see where the air flows over the wing to be the Kiwanda effect, but it also takes part of the air inside and circulates it around. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. And there's really no way that could fail, right?
No, it's good. I mean, it's super. Yeah. Anyway.
I'm thinking of like helicopters and stuff like that with rotors and stuff. This is just movement of the air, which is the propulsion, right?
Yep.
Yes.
In other words, it sucks itself. It creates a low pressure area ahead of it.
Right.
The fan is sucking in air and blowing it over the wing and then recirculating it. So it's like when you're going into a crowded saloon in the Old West and it's all packed in with people drinking their beer and they're right up to the double doors. If you go into the saloon at that time and just shove the doors open like that, you're going to meet what's called resistance because they're going to, you know, knock you on the head for knocking their beer out of their hands, right?
That's true.
But if you hang your hands over the side or the top of the barroom door and say, look, fellas, could you make a hole, let me in here? And so you clear a space and then you can come in without meeting resistance. And that's what happens in an entrainment drive. It's like breaststroking. You go like that. And in the water, you clear an area for your body to go into instead of forcing it. You are making a hole that you're then dropped into because it's a lower pressure. And if you do that rapidly, then you fly. Even underwater, these things work. Anyway, there you go. Now, back to the issues here. There's so many to talk about. Slide 47 was interesting. If you click on the picture, you'll see a picture of Turkey's Erdogan and Prime Minister Netanyahu having a discussion about who controls Jerusalem. In the text, it goes on to say, if you get the text, it'll give you the article. Erdogan of Turkey is saying Jerusalem is our city. And when he's saying our, you think it's probably meaning Turkey, which is what it is trying to tell you. But in essence, Netanyahu saying, well, we'll have to talk about that because we, you know, claim Jerusalem and hence Temple Mount, etc. So there's going to have to be a meeting of the minds on this to solve this because Ottoman is saying it's Israel's capital, but he's saying it's our city, or sorry, Jerusalem's the capital. Because these talks are now transpiring, it's probably going to mean that eventually Erdogan, Turkey, will endorse building the third temple for the Jews on the Temple Mount. It's been rumored in the news over there for the last 4 or 5 years in Turkey, I've been reading it, that they want to let the Israelis and the Muslims, you know, and a third sect, I'm not sure what it was, but anyway, worship on the Temple Mount in their area. So it would be open to the 3 or 4 major religions. And this is just another sign that things are coming together for that third temple period, which is part of prophecy in these days that we live.
Turkey's idea is from a pre-war Ottoman.
Yeah.
Okay, I get that. And the argument would be, or the alternative, I suppose, would be instead of building it on top of where the temple stood, it would be, much like, let's say a building came down on its own footprint and was there for centuries upon centuries. It'd be like building in the lot next to it. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, look, infrared photography done over the Temple Mount has proven that there was an area there for Solomon's, temple and the second temple as well. What they're proposing is to divide up the areas on top of the Temple Mount for, you know, each of the three religions. Now, you could actually build the third temple on the north side of the Temple Mount, which is where I think it's closer where the original one was, because it is not part of what is really being used for worship in the mosques. It would be a peace movement between Turkey and Israel. And Turkey being like where in Pergamon, where the seat of Satan is, you know, it might be a good place for the Antichrist to be from. I don't know, but Erdogan is on my list of potentials, but also his, like his deputy who's now resigned and is running for office. There is a Suleiman that, was in his cabinet that might be running for the position to take, control from Erdogan. Suleiman, Solomon the Great. Well, the Ottoman ruler that rebuilt the walls around the Temple Mount was Suleiman the Magnificent, the Great. You know, he was revered and still is revered. He's even on the subject of many TV serials in Turkey. So Solomon, I keep referring back to that in Revelation 13 about here wisdom is, pointing at 666, which points to Solomon and the wisdom of Solomon. Mm-hmm. And both, Muslims and Christians and also Jews, they revere Solomon. So it follows that a Solomonic type leader could garner the support of all three religions and build that temple there or let them build it. Just watch the news. It's slowly, well, rapidly actually at this point developing.
It's coming together.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now we've got, let's see how long we got there. Okay.
We've got 5 minutes more than you think we do. So.
Okay, good, good. In slide 66, just on the text, it says NASA asteroid hunters spot a flurry of new space rocks headed towards Earth after identifying mysterious new mini moon. Now there's something orbiting between the moon and Earth. A small blip on their radar, you know, they're trying to figure out what it is. Is it a small rock that's decided to orbit between the moon and us to become a mini moon? You know, like something that just got caught here, like one of the asteroids or the chunks off of it, a comet or whatever. It's new and exciting, but the pattern of its orbit does suggest it might be the leftover part of a prior launch of a small package, you know, a satellite or a crew. It might be the long cylindrical portion of the rocket that is, you know, jettisoned after the package reaches its destination. So it could be a chunk of an old missile, you know, floating around out there and giving us the illusion of a moon. Now, my question is, if we can image, you know, an asteroid, clear across the darn solar system nearly and say, okay, it looks like a potato or it's long like a sausage or whatever. Why can't they image something between the Earth and the Moon and say, oh, yeah, that's, you know, a NASA rocket or a Russian rocket that's just in Earth orbit. It came back, you know, after being launched out. It returned. Anyway, I don't know why it's such a big mystery if they can't do that. But, you know, now, okay, in the article, amid a flurry of asteroidal activity as we enter the final months of 2020, NASA's asteroid hunters have flagged five more space rocks that are en route, ranging in size from 5.5 meters all the way up to a whopping 45 meters in diameter, mean diameter, of course. And, you know, if they're going to come close to us, it's going to be interesting if they get deviated by events from the sun, you know, solar wind changes, or bump into something else on the way here. It's a good article to read. There we go.
All right.
What was I? Let's see. I think November the 2nd, on November the 2nd, we're supposed to have another meteor whose minimum distance is around 3,500 miles from the Earth. Now, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. Question is, when they say it's about 3,500 miles, is it closest it could be in its orbit? Because we aren't certain, you know, we can't get enough readings that are accurate enough to determine it. But we suspect that the minimum distance, the closest distance, would be 3,500 miles. Well, how do they measure that? I've asked them, they're not answering it by email. Is it from the surface of the Earth that is 3,500 miles, or is it from the center of the Earth, which is where you normally put your calculations for orbital bodies? So if that's the case, and the Earth's diameter is 4,000 miles or so, 35, let me figure that out. That's
that
a correct.
That would make a big difference.
Yeah. And, yeah, as I say, I wrote the authorities on that there, and they just either were too busy or didn't want to answer that. But I know my equations, I use the same ones that they do. It's a point at the center of the object that you use for your calculation of the orbit.
That makes sense, yeah.
Like Jupiter or something like that being huge like it is, if you use the surface of it, that would put your calculations off as opposed to the center of it, because right. It's huge. It's big, big.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's your science for the day. Here's something interesting in slide 55. The increase or loss of solar radiation, right, affects volcanic and earthquake activity. They've correlated that when the solar wind decreases like it is now, this is a solar minimum starting out the 25th cycle, the solar cycle, when it's at a minimum, they notice that volcanic activity increases. Now, you know, I try to figure out why. You know, they're trying to do the same thing. They're not sure what causes it. Let me see if I can find the article. Okay. There has been a significant amount of volcanic activity in recent weeks, including the latest eruptions in the Philippines at Taal Volcano, which that article is covering. But why is happening is still, they're thinking, well, maybe they're the solar wind is impinging on the spin of the planet, you know, our length of our day, and it puts a slight shock in there, which causes the weak areas to fracture underneath the volcanic cones and to let magma through it. But the bottom line is they don't know why. And so we can expect more volcanic activity now and for the next year or two at a sunspot minimum. Even though we're getting interesting sunspot activity, not as many, but the ones that we're getting are big and very active. So, you know, it's all integrated. The sun, the moon, the earth, gravitational fields, radiation, the magnetic fields, you know, between the sun and the earth. This is really interesting because the earth, as you know, our magnetic field is rapidly decreasing to zero. It's just a periodic change where it goes to zero and then reverses. It comes back out the opposite polarity and it's a pole reversal. But we're seeing that early now. And when that field weakens, of course, the ozone layer weakens. And what do we see at the South Pole? A humongous hole in the ozone layer. So our magnetic field is definitely weak enough to allow that to happen. Were that to occur over the United States, as I said before, it would fry us with ultraviolet radiation and other radiation that normally gets absorbed in the upper atmosphere and doesn't hit us. So as I say, the whole system is integrated. It's not that the sun is over there doing its thing and the earth is over here doing its thing. It's, we're all in a field that is interactive. Ripples in the orbits of planets affect us all. The slowing down of the sun and its spin rate, that would affect us all, or speeding up, vice versa.
Since you mentioned that, now this is a hypothetical question, and I'm really trying to work this out in my mind. Don't laugh at me for asking this, but if the Earth were to spin, slow in its spin as a, a day would be, 36 hours. Would we age? Would our aging process be slowed as well? Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. I'm just, the way we count in days, in a year, things like that might be interesting. It would be less days in a year, but you'd still be in the same orbit and everything. But I don't think it's going to change the physical aging process, which is, molecular chemistry at that level.
Okay. I figured as much, but I wanted to ask that question. Maybe I thought I was missing something. If we could somehow get the Earth to slow down, I could stop aging and...
Oh, look, I went through this slowing down the Earth and speeding up of the Earth and all that kind of stuff. I went over it for months and months when I was writing the Vindicator Scrolls, Volume 1, which, by the way, I'm now scanning one of the last copies we had left in the library here. We're going to make it available again as a flash drive copy of the Vindicator Scrolls, which covered Eden, Atlantis, Antichrist, science, technology, all kinds of stuff. So many people have been asking when we're going to reprint it. We're not going to reprint it because it's got so many color images in it that it would cost a fortune. It did cost a fortune last time. But anyway, we'll have that. But in the Vindicator Scrolls, I did look at the ages of Earth, and of the patriarchs in the Bible, some 900 years old and in the range of 600 to 950 so years. And looking at the spin rate of the Earth back then, which if it was spinning faster, which it was, would mean you'd have more days in the year because you would have spun around, more times when you reach the same spot around the sun. And it crossed my eyes a couple of times because looking at, the spin of the Earth versus its orbital component versus the angle of the sun, what caused it to deviate from from a meteor impact and that kind of stuff. But it's in the Vindicator Scrolls. You'll see the charts and on the edges, you'll probably see bloodstains, sweat and tears, It was a tough job. And I'm not sure I got it right anyway, because I had to look at what archaeologists have found in certain skeletons of small sea animals that made shells every season, in layer and layer and layer, telling how many seasons this sea animal went through. And I had to try to figure out how to balance what they found, for the age of the sea animals, versus what the spin orbit would have been. And as I say, it was an interesting excursion.
Okay. And I don't want to take you too far off your time and what you want to cover, but in museums, you'll see these tree sections with the rings and the little tab saying this is, when the Declaration of Independence was signed, the tree was, this ring, it was 1776. But based on the number of rings when it was cut down and such, and this is Christ's birth and such, and this is, 300 years before that. I don't know why I brought that up except to ask, is that kind of what you're talking about in a sense too?
The tree rings tell you definitely how many seasons it was for that tree. You bring up an interesting point about the tree. There is a photograph somewhere out there on the internet of a tree, this fossilized tree, in a coal mine when they were excavating in this vein. They went down, 30, 40 feet. And you find, looking up at this end here, you see a tree that's fossilized in the middle of the formation. It's a whole tree all the way down. But yet, there are layers, like you were talking about, layers in the sediment going up, showing the ages of the sedimentary deposit. And if you have 2,000 years of sediment, And at the very middle of it, all the way down to the bottom, you have this single tree that has lasted with all the sediment being deposited around it over, you know, thousands of years. That doesn't make sense. It had to happen. That sediment had to be in one or two seasons maximum. It had to cover that tree in not 2,000 years, but in a couple of years, because otherwise the tree would have been stunted and would not have grown up through all the layers like that. You see what I'm saying?
It's an
anomaly. It just points to the fact that a lot of the sedimentary process could take place in a couple of years rather than a couple of millennia. Stephen Austin's dissertation on the Mount St. Helens post period where it formed a miniature Grand Canyon with layers like that proves this point scientifically. Dr. Stephen Austin and the Mount St. Helens like paper he wrote. You can look it up on the internet. It's fascinating. Anyway.
Yeah, do that. All right. Thank you. Thanks for entertaining that thought. Okay.
Okay, on slide 56, volcanic upticks in Iceland and Russia have scientists concerned, is this an anomaly? Now, this is in line with what we were talking about just a while ago about the increase in volcanic activity when you have a solar wind minimum, which is what we're in at the moment. They say here, the sun is currently going through its deepest solar minimum of the past 100 and some odd years, and looking forward, NASA has revealed the next cycle, 25, which we've started now, could be the weakest of the past 200 years, a return to the Dalton minimum conditions. Now, that's Guy Dalton who figured it out for the sunspot activity. But at solar minimums, where you have this really deep minimum sunspot activity, like the late 1600s, and Europe suffered from this, the Thames River was frozen over so hard for several years that merchants had year-round stalls out there on the Thames River on the ice, you know, because of this Maunder minimum, which is part of the Dalton minimum period. But we're approaching a new minimum period, you know, the modern minimum, was what they call it, where, you know, we're going to have this extreme minimum sunspots. And I'm concerned in that this time the minimum number of sunspots may be a precursor to an activity that actually changing the reaction, the nuclear reaction in the sun to more fusion-based, I think it is, where it will throw off the outer shell of stuff because of hydrogen stuff because it's already burnt up half of it. So it's going to go to a helium reaction by fusion there. But anyway, I don't know. It's things that are in my brain bucket when I see the news. I try to put all the pieces together and fall asleep in the middle of figuring it out because it's so boring. But anyway.
Well, no, you do a good job of connecting the dots. I think that there's a lot of dots in the I don't know what in your world in the what would you call it, the geological, but the astronomical in the entire universe that need to be connected. That you do a good job of connecting. So anyway.
Yeah, you got archaeology, you got physics, you know, yeah. Astronomy, all this stuff has got to be, it's got to agree if you understand the model correctly.
Right.
It's problematic at times.
That's a good point.
5 minutes yet or what?
Yeah, we got about 5 minutes.
Okay, slide 59. Auroras without a solar storm. Yesterday, there was not a solar flare. There was no coronal mass ejection or CME and no solar activity of any kind. Auroras without a solar storm are a sign of the times. Then this happened. Click on that text in slide 59, and you see beautiful red and green auroral displays, which indicate, you know, an extreme amount of ionization in the upper atmosphere. The pinkish reddish stuff is oxygen being ionized rather than just nitrogen, you know, in the greener areas there. But this, yeah, they're saying there was no CME, there was no, magnetic fields or things that shot out from the sun. Nothing unusual happened. It was quiet. And yet all of a sudden we have this super high voltage, you know, auroral event at the North Pole. Why? And it's a good question. They have no idea. They think it's a crack that opened up in the Earth's magnetic field. So that's what they think, right? And if you have that crack, it allows more of the solar wind, you know, and the magnetic fields that come with it to inject itself into our Earth's electromagnetic system. But even that is a bit weird, because what is causing that crack in our magnetic field? The field is weakening. Is it starting to diverge in places so that we do have this kind of zone, which he called a crack, where the magnetic field is very much weaker than the average for the planet? Another one of those little mysteries that has got the scientists scratching their head.
Wow. All right. So I just, to be clear on this, maybe there might be another guy like me out there, person out there wondering the same thing. What I'm looking at in slide 59 in that image, that's not really light. Well, that's what am I looking at? Is it light?
You're looking at light. If you're up in the northern regions of the planet, you'd look at night, and sometimes during the long winter nights, you know, you'd see it certainly all the time. But in the darkness of the northern regions, and this happens, you see green and red light clouds like this just rolling, you know, kind of wafting like that across the sky.
Right.
It's light. It's produced when you charge up the atoms of, say, oxygen and nitrogen with the electromagnetic radiation coming from the sun or elsewhere. When you charge it up, it starts to luminesce, to throw off light, because it's got so much energy.
That's okay. That was my question. Where it originates? Does it originate from the sky or from the ground? But no, from itself.
Yeah, from the atmosphere. Yeah.
Right. Okay. All right. Yeah. That makes sense.
That's part of plasma physics. It's rather an interesting thing in itself, but that's another discussion.
I couldn't get past ciphering in school, so.
Ciphering. Ciphering. Yeah, boy, I remember that in the old wood schoolhouse. An interesting thing here, which is kind of just for your information type things, I stumbled across at slide 45. It's called virtual reality lenses. They're now going to be able to give you, this is what they're experimenting with, contact lenses that give you a heads-up display in your eye. And you know, it's like you can live a virtual reality over what you're seeing out in front of you. Like, you could be looking down the street, and your virtual reality, you could be reading, connect me to, in your mind, you could say, connect me to the internet and look for the street and that car thing there. What can you, its license number is such and such. You speak it, and in your virtual reality lenses, you're still seeing the car, but then you're seeing the readout coming in front of the car in your eyes. Yeah, it's science fiction, but that's what they're starting to look at now. It's a nice little video about that.
Wow.
Cool.
Yeah, that. I have enough trouble.
All right, one more slide.
Go ahead.
We've got it, slide 48. Amazon is developing a palm reading process so that you can use your palm to do trading with. Just another one of those things about mark in the right hand. Is it in the right hand on the palm side or on the hand? In, on. How does that translate from the Greek? Isn't that cool? When I say it's cool, it's like, you know, wow, this is fulfilling prophecy. This technology.
I don't know. I'm sorry. We don't need any of this, you know. This all fits together with what the picture you paint every week, as well as what we see with other news headlines. It's all coming together. You're right.
Okay.
So we're about out of time, my friend.
All right. Well, as I said, I probably wouldn't finish all these things this week, but you can get on the website and look at it, read the articles.
In fact, go to standao.com, go to the show images page and click through all of the links. And then, while you're there, support Stan and Holly Deo at their Patreon page as well. It's worthy of your support. That's standao.com. Support them. Holly does hard work, and as does Stan, and they need our support. Stan, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Lord bless you. See you next week.
Good night. Folks, that'll do it for me tonight. Did I run out of time? Did I run over? I did. All right. Have a great night, everyone. Good night.